On a Thursday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Who hasn't been driven crazy trying to watch a video online only to have it freeze, then start, then freeze again? The smooth loading of video clips, though, is not just important to viewers. As NPR's Sammy Yenigun reports, video providers also see it as critical.
Knock, knock.
You may have heard this one already.
Who's there?
You're showing a friend some hilarious video that you found online.
Dwayne.
And right before you get to the punchline.
Dwayne who?
A little loading dial pops up in the middle of the screen.
Dwayne the bathtub. I'm drowning.
Buffering kills comedic timing. And according to a study published by UMass professor Ramesh Sitaraman, it kills attention spans too.
What we found was that people are pretty patient for up to 2 seconds.
That's a really nice way of saying people are pretty impatient.
If you start out with, say, 100 users, if the video hasn't started in 5 seconds, about one quarter of those viewers are gone. And if the video doesn't start up in 10 seconds, almost half your viewers are gone.
If a video doesn't load in time, people get frustrated and click away. This may not come as a shock, but until now, it hadn't come as an empirically supported fact either.
This is really the first large-scale study of this kind that tries to relate video streaming quality to viewer behavior.
And when Professor Sitaraman says large-scale, he means it. The study looked at close to 6.7 million viewers who watched almost 23 million videos played. So how long is too long? Depends on the device.
We found that people who had a lot of connectivity had also a lot of expectation potentially, and so they abandoned much sooner.
For about half of the people who used a high-speed fiber optic connection, 5 seconds is too long to wait. Mobile users will wait longer. For a business that serves an ad base of 800 million people a month, every second counts. The more users that click away, the bigger the problem.
When we started to look into this problem, we found that kind of the existing player we had was not up to the task.
That's Andy Berkheimer, engineering manager for YouTube. For the past 2 years, his team has been working on a project that makes sure your knock-knock jokes are delivered without the pauses.
Dwayne the bathtub.
And so we had to rewrite our entire player to give us more flexibility in how we handled network conditions.
The need for flexibility has to do with bandwidth. Think of streaming video as being like a stream of liquid information. Bandwidth is the size of the pipe.
No matter where you are, no matter what type of device you're using, no matter what type of network you're on, at any time while you're watching a video, bandwidth can change.
So if that bandwidth or pipe constricts too much, the video stops playing. Here's how YouTube is solving this problem. They chop the video into a bunch of tiny pieces. From moment to moment, depending on how much bandwidth is available, they swap these pieces in and out as the video streams. So if there's a ton of bandwidth, a high-definition piece flows down the pipe. But if that pipe constricts, even for a second, a lower-quality piece is swapped in.
And that way we can keep the data flowing uninterrupted, and we can choose a quality level that is right for the bandwidth conditions at that moment.
And less load time means more video, more eyeballs, and more money for ads. But what's the cost? Some films aren't always seen in their best light. For example, filmmaker Gregory Wilson just used state-of-the-art camera equipment to film a cheetah running full speed in super slow motion. HD captures every stunning detail of the cat's fluid motion. But when you watch it online, who knows how it will look?
I would hope that, you know, the quality could be the best that it could be and be more on par with what I had originally captured.
But since businesses need that video to run no matter what it looks like, the rest of us will likely see grainy cheetahs rather than stuttering punchlines. Sammy Yenigun, NPR News.
Television makers are trying to find the next big thing that will get you to throw out your current TV and buy a new one. They thought it might be 3D TV. That didn't work out. So now they've come up with something new. They're showing it off this week at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is where we found Rich Jaroslawski. He writes about technology for Bloomberg News, and he told us about the newest viewing experience.
It's called Ultra HD TV, and it's designed basically to make you think that the snazzy HD TV that you have in your den is as inadequate as the old CRT TVs that you had before you replace them with the snazzy new HD TVs.
Mm-hmm. people who've been following this know that HD TV is just a far, far sharper picture. The color is supposed to be much more vivid. You can see far more wrinkles and flaws in people's faces. So what's it look like when you look at Ultra HD TV? Do you see even more flaws and wrinkles?
Well, essentially, imagine what you see in your den right now and then quadruple it. You can see pores. You can see the veins on leaves. It's very immersive. You can get up really close, and you don't see the dots that make up the picture. These Ultra HD TVs have four times the pixel count of the existing HD TVs, and they're actually working on ones that will have eight times the pixel count.
Who was showing it off, and what did it look like? What were they showing on screen?
Well, almost all the major manufacturers that are here, Samsung, LG, Toshiba, Sony, most of them are promising to bring some of these to market sometime this year. Sony has, I believe, an 84-incher out for a cool $25,000. But they all have created content specifically to show off the TVs, whether it's, forest shots or cityscapes. And that raises one of the issues about these TVs, which is, where is the content going to come from? Most of the content that's available today is not created for Ultra HD TV. And so you're going to have to ask the question of who's going to create the programming for this and how's it going to get there.
Oh, because anything that I watch is going to be in the older format. And then I guess there's the question of getting it to me, especially if I am getting programming via the Internet. Is there the bandwidth for four times as much image on the same screen?
That's a big question. Right now, nobody is quite saying just how long it would take to download something. And since TV is increasingly moving to the Internet, that is one of the big questions. Another one is whether broadcasters, cable operators, will be willing to create Ultra HD channels. So I think initially what they're going to be doing is to sell these things as a better HD experience. But the real power of this won't get unlocked until you have the content available on cable systems, on satellite systems, and over the Internet to be able to run these programs in their native mode.
That raises a key question for me, Rich Jaroslawski. As you were looking at the Ultra HD TV screens, did you cry? Did your heart beat faster? Did you fall in love with the person on screen? What happened?
Well, I have to admit that at a certain point, I got a faraway look in my eyes, and I began to imagine having one of these in my study at home or in the den, and maybe watching my beloved San Francisco Giants in glorious Ultra HD TV. But then when I saw the price tags that are going to be on these things, at least initially, it sort of snapped me back to reality.
Maybe you don't need to see every single stitch on the baseball.
$25,000 for even for an 84-inch TV is not a discussion I think I'd like to have with my family.
Rich Jaroslawski, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks so much, Steve.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. 2012 was the year of mobile commerce. That's according to some tech analysts. That means consumers weren't just browsing on their smartphones and tablets. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, they were typing in their credit card numbers and hitting buy.
They knew it would happen. Eventually, says Clark Frederick of the research firm eMarketer. And last year, Frederick says consumers made the leap to mobile in record numbers.
Mobile commerce went from a negligible portion of retail e-commerce sales a couple years ago to 11% in 2012, which is substantial.
Frederick says last year, consumers hit the buy button on mobile devices to the tune of $25 billion. Part of the reason there was so much growth is that a lot more people have iPads, Kindles, and other tablet computers.
People like shopping on tablets. Tablets have a high-resolution display, fingertip browsability, instant power on, and it makes them ideal devices for shopping.
Amazon has been a real leader in the mobile market. Its Kindle was the first tablet computer to excite consumers, though the original only made it easy to buy books. But now the Kindle makes it easy to buy everything on the Amazon site, from books to shoes. And Amazon has apps for iPads, iPhones, Android phones.
Matter of fact, our goal is for someone to go from wanting something to buying it in under 30 seconds.
That's Sam Hall, who is the vice president of mobile shopping at Amazon. Hall says Amazon saw a big uptick in purchases made on mobile devices this past holiday season. He thinks mobile devices have changed the idea of what it means to go shopping.
Shopping doesn't need to be a single event where I'm sitting in front of my PC or going to a store. I can buy a gift for someone wherever I am. I could be in line at Starbucks. I could be in a boring meeting. I could be sitting on the couch.
Big companies like Amazon enjoy a large advantage in that they have the resources to make their mobile shopping experience easy. Andrew Gazdecki, the CEO of Business Apps, which helps build shopping apps, says small businesses are realizing they need to invest in mobile.
If they don't have a mobile experience, there's been studies that show that customers will bounce over to competitors' websites.
Gazdecki says ease of use is crucial to success. He says everyone from restaurants to jewelry stores are getting into the mobile game. Clearly, we are reaching the point where if you can think it, you can buy it right then and there. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
That big consumer electronics show in Las Vegas ends today. And while big tech firms like Google and Apple did not attend, an increasingly diverse range of companies took their place. With more and more devices connecting to the internet, many companies are flocking to this festival of gadgets, hoping to bring all the appliances in your home online. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
The internet isn't just for people anymore. What began as a way for human beings to communicate using computers, smartphones, or tablets has evolved into a network that's connecting more and more machines to each other. And the machines have a lot to say. Meet Ivy.
Hello, Ivy.
That's Jonathan Nostrad, the founder and CEO of the company that makes Ivy.
What's the weather in London on Saturday?
Saturday in London, the temperature will be 34 degrees. You can expect partly cloudy skies mid-morning.
Ivy is a next-generation alarm clock.
So we started making voice-activated talking alarm clocks, and basically what we found is that people like to talk to devices. The biggest benefit with our products today is that they can set the time of the alarm, but tomorrow they're going to be able to do so much more.
Say you're chilly, just tell Ivy to turn up the heat.
Okay, I've set your thermostat to 73.
Sensors that can connect to the net are already embedded in some thermostats, scales, door locks, light switches, windows, and even some sprinkler systems. This is supposed to be the future, right? The smart, connected home.
Typically, people see the phone and the tablet as being the only interface to interact with the smart home.
But Nostrand thought, why not just talk to it? I mean, do you really want to use your iPhone to turn on and off the lights?
Instead of taking out your phone out of your pocket, sliding over the bar, hitting the app to get in the app, going to the button, selecting the lights on or off, why not just say, hello, Ivy, turn the lights on?
The thing is, Ivy is just one of dozens of different companies which are competing to get the smart home to actually work. There are crowd-funded startups like SmartThings. There are security companies like ADT and Alarm.com. Even giant telecoms like Verizon. I want to sell you something to help you connect every little appliance you own to the net. There's even one very big hardware store getting into this act, Lowe's.
My name's Kevin Ma, and my title VP of Smart Home for Lowe's.
When did Lowe's decide that it needed a VP for Smart Home? How long have you had this job?
Exactly a year, just a little over a year. But
Mara's been building connected gadgets for so-called smart homes for more than a decade.
You walk out to your car, and frankly, everything in your car works, interacts with each other. You've got central locking, electric windows, the door locks when you turn the ignition on. You know, there's a logic to the way all these things work.
In the home, Mar says these same kinds of technologies could help save energy and water. They could make your home safer. They could even send you a text if an elderly parent doesn't get up and fire up the coffee maker at the usual time.
Everything but everything is going to be connected to the internet.
And a lot of good could come of that. So Lowe's created a simple control system called Iris. You can install yourself that can talk to almost any connected appliance Lowe's sells. In the past, companies built different kinds of sensors into products And all these little gizmos couldn't talk to each other.
And that's the advantage we have at Lowe's. We sell all this stuff, and we can talk with our vendors, and we can say, look, guys, I want you to make it so that when it connects this way.
And if you're an executive at, say, Pella Windows or Whirlpool, when Lowe's calls, you take the call. So if you've been waiting years for a smart fridge to go with your smartphone, that wait could possibly be coming to an end. Steve Henn, NPR News.
A lot of the email spam that winds up in people's mailboxes promises cheap medicines online. Viagra is among the drugs for sale this way. Many people who receive these emails may wonder who's selling this stuff and if anybody's really buying. Turns out the emails come from partnerships between spammers and rogue online pharmacies. Tracy Samuelson of NPR's Planet Money team reports on the dark side of the internet.
The inner workings of these industries actually emerged from a feud between two competing black market pharmacies. In their heyday, they were two of the biggest rogue pharmacies in the world. Then someone hacked their digital files, and they ended up in the hands of Brian Krebs, who reports on cybersecurity for his own site, Krebs on Security.
We're talking about the contact information, the bank account information, the email addresses, phone numbers, sometimes passport information, for many of the biggest spammers on the planet.
Plus the order history and credit card information of over a million customers of these two black market pharmacies, Rx Promotion and Spam It.
These two programs, Rx Promotion and Spam It, probably are responsible for upwards of 50 or 60% of the spam that you or I got in our inboxes over the last 5 years. It's just a ridiculous amount of problems that these guys cause.
Stefan Savage, a professor of computer science and engineering at UC San Diego, also got a look at this data, and he used it to study the business model behind this usually hidden industry. At the center are these international pharmacies, often in places like Russia. But because they're in a shady business, selling prescription drugs without prescriptions, they can't simply run ads on TV. They need some other way to get the word out about their product, their pills. And historically, that's meant spam.
We wouldn't call what they're doing legitimate. It's illegal in this country. But the fundamental practice is they are trying to advertise this product.
The spammer is like an independent contractor. They get paid on commission. And in these leaked documents, you can actually read conversations where an online pharmacy employee tries to recruit a hot new spammer to his team. Hey, how about spamming for us? The employee asks in an instant message. What are the payment conditions? The spammer replies. Well, the employee says, most people get to keep about 30% of their sales. But the spammer, he counters that he's really good at his job, that he has the ability to send 500 million spam emails in a single day. Eventually, the spammer and the online pharmacy employee, they agree the spammer will keep 40% of his sales. So that's the advertising piece. But once the customer's gone to the site and chosen their drug of choice, then the pharmacy takes over. They find someone to process the credit card payment, and then they actually have to get the drugs to the customer.
They don't actually typically warehouse any drugs themselves. So they'll contract with third parties who have access usually to generic drug manufacturing in India and China.
So now one question you might be asking is, are these drugs actually real? A guy named Dave Keck had that question as well when he ordered an acne medication called Accutane from a pharmacy in Latvia.
I called Walgreens and they said it was going to be about $600 for a month's supply of what I researched is what I should take. And on this online pharmacy, I think it was like $40 for the same amount. So that was a no-brainer.
Keck knew the risk, both of taking a very strong drug without a doctor's supervision and of ordering drugs from abroad. It's technically illegal, and he worried it might be a scam. But he decided to give it a go. He watched his credit card like a hawk for extra charges. And then a few weeks later, he got a package from Turkey.
What I got from this pharmacy was in like kind of a binder, and they included one packaging of the actual of the medicine, but the rest was just kind of taped down to the inside of this binder. So it looked pretty suspicious.
But the pills were in sealed blister packs with branding that looked more legitimate, just in Turkish. So Keck wondered whether the pills were real medicine or not. He figured no one would go through all this effort just to poison him.
Now, I was thinking poison's just going to be more expensive. These people probably just want to make money. So it's going to be a sugar pill or the real deal. And after I had taken it for about a week, I was 100% sure that it was the real deal just based on the side effects.
His skin dried up, his lips got really chapped, and his acne went away. So a lot of people who order from these pharmacies are ordering erectile dysfunction drugs like Viagra. But Stefan Savage, the researcher, says up to 15% of orders come from customers like Keck, people who turn to these sites to treat everyday health problems, likely because they can't afford legal avenues to buy their medications. And according to Savage, people seem to mostly get what they pay for.
I'll say over 800 orders, we've maybe only had one time when we didn't get something. For legal reasons, we can't buy every drug, and we're not equipped to test everything. I will say that drugs that we have tested, the right active ingredient has appeared in the right amount.
Not all online pharmacies operate in the black market, but the Food and Drug Administration says Americans should only order from sites that are licensed and located in the U.S. Otherwise, there might not be proper oversight. And if these drugs wind up making you sicker in the long run, it's actually not such a bargain. Tracy Samuelson, NPR News.
Now for a look at how all of our old gadgets, you know, the stuff you're throwing in the drawers, throwing out, are harming the environment. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. produces more than 2.5 million tons of electronic waste each year. The majority of this e-waste goes unrecycled, so most of our discarded electronics are ending up in landfills. And this is raising some serious health and environmental concerns. Is there a good way of getting rid of our old cell phones? Could we better engineer the phones to use greener ingredients? Derek Markham is a journalist and contributing writer for treehugger.com. He took a closer look at the growing e-waste problem and its consequences. He did a recent article for the website. He joins us by phone from Silver City, New Mexico. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Tell us what's the definition of e-waste?
Well, e-waste is probably the easiest. It's anything that has a battery and a circuit board that you power on. Most of it is the portable stuff. We tend to hang on to our, you know, desktop stuff longer, but it could include, you know, things like TVs and stereos as well.
Wow. In your story, you focused on cell phone recycling, and you said the EPA estimates that less than 1 in 10 mobile phones are recycled, and only about 25% of all e-waste is collected for recycling. Why are these numbers so low?
That is correct. I think maybe part of it is they don't account for maybe some of those are being resold or reused, so that could be a small part of it. But I think that maybe people just don't know that, you know, while these resources do wonderful things inside our gadgets, you know, at the end of their life, they can contaminate our air and our water, and maybe they don't realize the importance of it. And the other factor is maybe it's not very simple for people.
Yeah,
not obvious.
Yeah, we don't have recycling centers spread around, you know, in supermarkets and things for you to drop your phone off here.
Right, right.
And I get, you know, sort of like the old light bulbs with the mercury in them problem.
Yeah, and if you don't make it easy, chances are it's not going to happen. And so there are programs, but oftentimes you need to send it somewhere else, and we're oftentimes not going to make that extra step.
Is it possible to engineer a cell phone that might be greener when you throw it away?
I don't know if I could speak to that. I have to say that I think that there are, have been some big advances in materials, but maybe on a fundamental electronic level, we still have to use these same precious metals. But I know that plastics are getting greener and greener every day. So that's one thing that could be changed.
And like light bulbs, which have mercury in them, is mercury one of the main culprits in our cell phones?
You know, most of it is lead and mercury. And then the batteries, especially those, you know, lithium ion batteries, they can end up, you know, especially if they get incinerated, but even in a landfill, those things can leach out into our groundwater.
Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to recycle your cell phone or your laptop or anything else, is there a place you can go online to find out how to do that?
Yeah, there's quite a few of them. I looked up a couple. There's one that's eCycle.com. The EPA also has a pretty good index for, you know, how to find these places. There's another one called eCyclingCentral.com. Where you can look up local things, and I also advise people to talk to their, you know, local landfill or, you know, contact your carrier or the maker of your phone, because I truly believe that that's something that they could, you know, do better is Yeah. At least make it easy when you're getting that new phone to drop off the old one so that it gets recycled or reused.
Or maybe, you know, even on the box where the phone comes in, it has a label already stuck on it for sticking it back in the mail.
Yeah, that would be a phenomenal idea.
Yeah, well, we sometimes come up with an idea. Well, thank you very much, Derek, for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Derek Markham, journalist and contributing writer for treehugger.com based in Silver City, New Mexico.